This recording is for institutional communication use only. The views expressed represent an assessment of market conditions at a specific point in time or opinions only and should not be relied upon as investment advice regarding a particular investment or markets in general. Such information does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell specific securities or investment vehicles. It should not be assumed that any investment will be profitable or will equal the performance of the portfolios or any securities or any sectors mentioned herein. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. To obtain a prospectus containing this and other information, please call 212-259-0430 or download the file from www.exoticfunds.com. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Investment returns and principal value of the fund will fluctuate so that shares may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance may be higher or lower than the performance data quoted above. For current performance information, please call 816-843-7623. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. The fund is newly organized with limited operating history. The fund is classified as a non-diversified under the 1940 Act. A non-diversified fund is not limited by the 1940 Act with regard to the percentage of its assets that may be invested in the securities of a single issuer. Consequently, the securities of a particular issuer or a small number of issuers may constitute a significant portion of the fund's investment portfolio. Alps Distributors Incorporated is the distributor of the Exotic Strategic Income Fund. Exotic Capital LLC and Alps Distributors are not affiliated. Alps Distributors Incorporated is not affiliated with Exotic Funds, SkyPoint Capital Partners, or Compass Distributors. SkyPoint Capital Partners LLC serves as the wholesale marketing agent for Exotic Funds.
Greetings and welcome to the Exotic Quarterly Investor Call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, February 2nd, 2021. I would now like to turn the conference over to Brian Smith. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Welcome, everyone, and Happy New Year. We'd like to thank you for joining the Exotic Strategic Income Fund quarterly call. My name is Brian Smith, CEO of SkyPoint Capital. The end of 2020 marked the one-year anniversary for the Exotic Strategic Income Fund, which today stands at $875 million in AUM. For the fourth quarter 2020, the institutional share class returned 2.3% to investors. Collectively, as a firm, Exotic Capital managed $3.7 billion and employs 52 investment professionals. And now on to our speakers. Founder Clay DiGiacinto serves as a managing partner and CIO for Exotic. Prior to forming the firm, Clay served as a head of mortgage trading for Tower Research Capital and as vice president in the fixed income, currency, and commodities group at Goldman Sachs and Company. Clay received a degree in mechanical engineering from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and his MBA in finance and statistics from the Wharton School of Business. Clay also served as a captain in the U.S. Army in the 25th Infantry Division from 1995 to 2000. Joining Clay on our call is his partner and co-head of credit, Jamshed Engineer. Jamshed joined Exotic at inception and is responsible for trading and portfolio management across the firm's credit business. Previously, Jamshed also served as vice president at Tower Research Capital and was in the fixed income, currency, and commodities group at Goldman Sachs and Company, with responsibilities for structuring, valuing, and advising on diverse securitization products for both principal and third-party transactions. Jamshed received a degree in finance and accounting from the University of Mumbai and his MBA in finance from the University of Southern California. Lastly, joining us is Simon Siminski. Simon joined Exotic in 2018 as a portfolio manager with a focus on the institutional aviation business. Since joining the firm, Simon and Exotic have been active participants in the aircraft ABS market and have remained active post-COVID. Previously, Simon led Deutsche Bank's aircraft ABS origination efforts. And prior to joining Deutsche Bank, Simon was a member of Guggenheim Partners Investment Management Structured Products Team, who were also early participants in the aircraft ABS market. With that, I would like to turn our call over to Clay.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate everybody joining today. I'd like to talk a little bit about the portfolio. sort of where we've been and where we're going, and then really similar to how we went into the last call, pretty deep into multifamily. I think we'd like to do the same thing today as it relates to our aviation assets, because this is one part of the portfolio that's been a contributor to outsized performance recently, and we think it'll continue to be an outsized performer in the future. You know, listen, I'm glad we just passed our one-year anniversary. It should be noted that for the first 3 months of this fund in existence, the AUM was less than $1 million. We only really got going in April of 2020 in significant inflows where we were able to invest. And that happened to coincide with pretty interesting timing. You know, COVID was an extraordinary event that brought significant buying opportunity to structured credit assets across the board. You know, when I think about when we started this fund, and, you know, Exonic has been in the private fund space for going on 12 years now. We launched our first fund, our first private fund in 2009. And when we launched the Daily Fund, we wanted to deliver a low-vol, you know, coupon-oriented fixed income substitute fund. Invest in structured credit assets across the capital structure and have some relative value acumen across individual pockets of structured credit. What we ended up getting, certainly when we launched in significant size, sort of April, May, June, July, is we got a high vol, total return opportunity where cash flow analysis dominated. And when you sort of introduce a firm that can and does look at the fundamental nature of the assets underlying securitizations, comes up with a prepayment, a default, and a recovery scenario, and then is able to, what I call it is sort of structural alpha, or be able to look within the securitization capital structure and pick the bond or the asset that represents the most bang for the buck. That's a very powerful position to be in when we see indiscriminate selling, which is what we saw in the sort of Q1 and Q2 of 2020. So where are we today? Well, we're in a scenario or we're in a position where cash flows matter, fundamentals count, it's a bond picker's market, and it's an incredible opportunity to create alpha with total return as well as a coupon component. So we're not back to this low-vol, coupon-oriented fixed income substitute completely, but we will get there. I think it's probably this year. But in the meantime, there's an incredible opportunity to find bonds and find opportunities that we think outperform over the short to medium term, both from a coupon and a cash flow component. But there is some total return left in the portfolio. Our average dollar price is now at 89 cents on the dollar. Duration is just less than 2 years. You know, like Brian mentioned, we're approaching $900 million in AUM. I think what we've communicated to most of you is that this is a fund where we expect and want to be nimble and thoughtful. And so we sort of thought about a soft cap around $2 billion. That'll allow us to achieve what we set out to do, which is to be able to invest across themes opportunistically. Structured credit comprises RMBS, CMBS, commercial real estate loans, the variety of asset-backed securities out there, student loans, auto ABS, auto lease ABS, aircraft ABS, et cetera. CLOs, there's even some CMBS and Resi IO. CRT would be considered a part of structured credit. And what we think about this fund, it's an opportunity to not only use our fundamental domain analysis to really think about the cash flow profile, but we also want it to be a go-anywhere fund within structured credit. So always investing where we get the optimal return for the level of risk that we're taking. And, you know, what COVID brought us, or certainly in the post-COVID world, is this extraordinary opportunity to look at the fundamentals and apply a pretty heavy discount rate to the cash flow profile and still be able to buy these. And what I mean by that is, and as we sort of segue to aviation here, in 2009, when we first started the fund, we were able to apply extraordinary prepayment, default, and recovery scenarios to subprime-like assets, meaning ultra-conservative. And then we were able to put a discount rate on it of 15 or 20%. And I haven't seen an opportunity like that until we saw aviation assets over the summer, where we could have fairly harsh scenarios, meaning, you know, relatively draconian, or in our case, because we're buyers of the asset, conservative, and also apply a hefty discount rate to those assets. And so we've allocated across our funds to more aviation asset-backed opportunities. I don't want to steal Simon or Jumpset's thunder, but we can talk about how those have performed over time and then what we see going into the future. Our key allocations right now and what I think are big differentiators are ABS, CMBS. In CMBS, it remains an inefficient market. We have we've added some CMBS IOs, SASB, that means single asset, single borrower, and multifamily re-remix backed from Freddie originated collateral, so Freddie K series and Freddie small balance. And we've been in that mezzanine part of the capital structure, so generally not first loss and certainly not AAA. What I think it's important to know, sort of how we think and how we differentiate, is cash flows matter. Nobody here buys a bond simply thinking that it goes from 90 to 95 tomorrow. We buy a bond at 90 because we think the ultimate disposition of all the cash flows that will accumulate over time will get us our 90 cents on the dollar back, plus some return above and beyond that level. And when we do a lot of this fundamental analysis, I think it's really important to differentiate the things that we've invested in. So Axonic has been around for 12 years. We're great partners with Freddie Mac. We've been in their credit risk transfer program on both the resi side as well as the commercial side for a while. And we're one of the largest participants in their Freddie small balance commercial space, buying the B pieces for our private funds. But specifically, Axonic has never bought one conduit B piece. So think about that for a second. We have resident expertise in cash flows of multifamily, office, retail type assets, and we've never participated across any of our funds in a B piece of a conduit deal. But we have participated in multiple B piece and mezz parts of the capital structure with Freddie multifamily collateral. And the reason that is I can't stress enough how much the cash flows matter. When we're buying that mezzanine piece or B piece from a conduit securitization, we're not levered to the mean and standard deviation of the underlying structure, collateral risks. We're only levered to the left tail. And so we've never gotten comfortable with the worst one or two or three or five loans in that pool to put ourselves in that first loss or mezzanine position in conduit B pieces, simply because the downside, the upside that we could have received doesn't compensate us for the downside that we're incurring. And so one of our strengths is really not necessarily all the bonds that we buy that we think are accretive to the portfolio, but we miss a lot of bonds that we think are destructive to the portfolio, and this is a perfect example. So we've loaded up on agency partnerships, the conduits and re-remix, and also on the commercial side, we've loaded up on SASB. SASB stands for single asset, single borrower. This is, you know, even though we may be at the same part or the mezzanine part of the capital structure in a SASB-type deal, the reason why we can get comfortable with it is because it's one asset. we can get very comfortable with that one loan or multiple properties underlying one loan, and that's far differentiated from a conduit deal, which may just be a hodgepodge of multiple loans. Similar in the resi space. Most of our resi assets are on the legacy side, meaning the differentiator there is probably pre 2008 type loans. We know it. There's plenty of pay history around those loans. There's HPA embedded in most of the underlying assets. And these are borrowers that have mostly paid their mortgage on time for the past 12, 13, 14 years. And we think there's some really interesting convexity profile to these assets. But I mention this because I think it's important to differentiate away from or compare it to non-QM, which is a relatively new asset class. It's mainly self-employed or stated income borrowers. And I think that, us staying away from the non-QM asset class for the most part, certainly when we launched this fund a year ago, has really served us well, not necessarily because the upside is better, but that we think the downside is better. And we've seen this sort of prove out in cash flows over time, meaning that forbearance numbers and foreclosure numbers for the non-QM asset class versus the legacy asset class within RESI has been much, much better. We're about 33% CMBS, 30% RMBS, 17% ABS, and 6% opportunistic, and then we have a 14% cash holding right now. I would expect cash to go down over time. We're comfortable holding less cash, but we want to be very pragmatic and thoughtful in how we're deploying that cash, make sure that we're not stepping on any landmines, and try to build a convexity profile within the book that we think makes a lot of sense. And we can do that when assets trade, when we're able to accumulate assets at 89 cents on the dollar. I guess now I'd like to turn it over to Jamshed and Simon to talk about aviation, ABS in particular, how we're thinking about the fundamentals there, the collateral and upside that we see to the portfolio. And then after that, we can open it up to questions. Jamshed?
Thanks, Clay. We're very excited about the upside in aviation right now. As everyone knows, aviation was one of the hardest hit sectors because of COVID. The aviation ABS market declined significantly during the sell-off in March, more due to technicals and liquidity rather than long-term fundamentals. These assets fell from par to deeply distressed levels like in a matter of a few days. The secondary market for A's and B bonds, which are senior bonds and mezz bonds, has since stabilized. As Clay mentioned, we are fundamental cash flow buyers, and when COVID hit, we conducted a thorough reset of all our assumptions with respect to three key areas. One, the decline in contractual revenue, decline in future lease rates, and finally, the decline in future aircraft values or disposition values. We knew a key driver of this was the timing of a viable vaccine, and we actively monitored and tracked research in this space. Based on this assessment, we concluded that the market had massively overreacted and that prices of A's and B's were extremely attractive. We started adding to these bonds in May 2020 and have continued to add. Just to give people an example of the magnitude of the move, the A bonds went from par to around a $70 price at the lows. These are single A rated assets. The B's, which are triple B rated assets, went from par to mid 40s at the lows. While other markets recovered quickly post-March, the aviation market recovery was tempered until the vaccine announcement in early to mid-November. This caused a significant increase in demand, and from then to now, we have seen a strong rebound across A, B, and C tranches. ASICS currently has around 16% of exposure to aviation. The A's and B's we still think are trading at extremely attractive levels given their ratings when compared to other asset classes. On average, they're trading 150 basis points to 250 basis points wider. Given the limited number of people who want to sell at the current prices, we believe it would be extremely difficult to replicate the exposure we have in our portfolio right now. We expect this market to further strengthen as the vaccine rollout continues. As we mentioned earlier, Simon joined us in late 2018. We have a team of dedicated aviation professionals who are recognized as thought leaders in the space, and we invest throughout the cap stack. We tailor our approach for what we think is the most a relative value, and we size our investments accordingly. For ASICS, we primarily invest in A's and B's, as I mentioned, both of which are currently cash flowing, despite the impact that COVID has had in this space. There are a few unique factors with regard to aviation assets that we think are important to highlight. One is the aircraft values. So in general, like aircraft are depreciating assets, and they depreciate by approximately 4% every year. Prior industry shocks did not really destroy long-term value, as the initial depreciation, was concentrated right after the shock, and over the next few years, there was very little, if any, further depreciation. After a period of approximately 5 years, the actual values converged with the pre-shock values. We saw this in 2001. That was the last sort of big shock we saw in the aviation space, which was a culmination of the SARS as well as 9/11. The other important thing to note is that ABS vehicles are not forced to sell their assets, which is extremely important given the technicals that we saw in March. These assets are not expected to be sold until anywhere from 2025 to 2027. There's also a very strong supply-demand technical with regard to aviation assets. The global fleet size in terms of number of seats is expected to decline in excess of 10% versus 2019. This is mostly driven by cancellation of new deliveries, retirement of older assets, and retirement of out-of-favor large wide-body asset types such as A380s and 747s. Our expectation is that air travel in the next few years will exceed 2019 levels, and this will result in higher utilization rates per seat and higher profit margins eventually for the airlines. Our portfolio was deliberately constructed to focus on a narrow body. So just to take a step back, broadly speaking, the aircraft types can be broken up into a narrow body and wide body. We always favored narrow-body aircraft just because the operating costs are much lower, they're more easily transferable, and the friction cost is less versus a wide-body. Approximately 90% of our holdings are narrow-body aircraft, and the A320-200 and the 737-800, which are the two I would say, the best narrow bodies out there, those are core to our holdings. versus the other out-of-favor assets. We continue to think that aviation has room to grow. There was a new issue deal that was extremely well received in the market that priced in January. They were the B tranche, which we took part in, as well as the C tranche, were 11 times oversubscribed and 9 times oversubscribed. The B is printed at a yield of 6.75%, and immediately on the follow, they tightened into closer to a 6% yield. The C is just priced around a 7.5% yield. So we think there's going to be more a new issuance in the next, in the next several months, and we continue to be optimistic on aviation and the upside we have in the portfolio right now. With that, I'll hand it back to Clay if there's anything else Clay wants to add before we open it up.
Yeah, I think that's a great synopsis. You know, one of the things that I hope listeners come away from is that the same detail that we think about and bring to the aviation market, we think about on all of the underlying assets as it relates to structured credit. So very detailed, multifaceted framework to thinking about the assets. And then we get the luxury of what I call structural alpha, which is thinking about where in the securitization does it make most sense to participate. And having expertise in both of those is I think what really matters when you're a structured credit investor, and that's how we built and framed a business now for 12 years, and I think it served us quite well. At that, Brian, I guess we can open it up to questions.
Great presentation. Operator, can we please open the phone lines for questions, please?
Certainly. If you'd like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. Once again, to register a phone question, it is the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. One moment, please, for the first question. And our first question comes from the line of Thassan Faiz. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, good morning. This is Hassan Faiz from Mortem Capital. Thanks for the call. Clay, I think when we first invested about 10 months ago, I think the opportunity set was in the, obviously, the legacy RMBS space. Can you elaborate a little bit the opportunity set there? Obviously, you're identifying this new area of aircraft ABS as well now. So as far as guidance, return guidance going forward for the whole portfolio, just wondering if you can maybe quantify that a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, listen, you know, part of the luxury of managing a multi strat portfolio within the structured credit domain is that it allows us to go to where the opportunity really meets our return threshold and return hurdle. So, aviation is always something that we found really interesting. You know, we've added to it. It's been a contributor to performance. But Resi has been core. We have an expertise in residential RMBS cash flows. It's core across all of our funds. I think I'll hand the question over to Jamshed, who's a partner co-head of credit, but also focuses on the RMBS book, to talk about the opportunity there and some of the convexity that we're trying to build into these portfolios from here, because we do think it'll remain core. And listen, this is a bond picker's market, so we're happy to talk about sectors. But Jamshed, I would ask you to go in a little bit about the relative bonds that you can pick within the sectors that we think create outperformance.
Sure. So as Clay mentioned, you know, we have around 29% of AUM is in resi. Majority of that is in a legacy resi, you know, which is something that Clay and I have been, doing since 2000, at least I've been doing since 2006, and Clay and I have been working together since 2009 on it. Right now, you know, there are, I would say, two main themes that we focus on in a legacy, which we think will outperform. One is the call option trade, and the other is the credit upside trade, and the forbearance upside is sort of part of the credit upside trade. So legacy resi is one of the only asset classes out there where you can still buy it at a substantial discount. So Clay mentioned non-QM and CRT, you know, and our view really hasn't changed on those two. We think there are opportunities within them, but at the same time, you still are buying assets at or above par, and it's mostly a spread play. With legacy resi, there is a fundamental component to it. Home prices were up 8% last year. That's the highest year-over-year increase since 2014. If you look at how legacy resi, you know, is structured and works, we are still buying assets in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, some of these are taking losses. They won't get far back. But there's a lot of upside to faster prepayments, lower defaults, lower losses. And you really don't have that upside when you look at a CRT deal or you look at a new issue non-QM deal where you're buying something at par and the best case is you get par back. You know, given the low rate environment, prepays are going to stay elevated, which is obviously great for legacy resi. It's bad for anything that has a premium. You know, going back to your specific question on the yield, you know, we think our legacy resi book is going to generate a high single-digit yield this year. We think a lot of it, you know, came back last year. So if we look at, you know, the different markets we're in, legacy resi was probably the quickest to come back. CRT, non-QM also came back relatively quickly. But there's still a lot of room to run on in the legacy resi trade. Just as an example, for our call option trade, you know, we like there was hardly any deals were called in 2020, given what happened. But in 2021, we've already seen multiple deals getting called by NRZ. So I think 13 deals got called this month. And we would expect the volume of deals getting called to significantly increase given where rates are. And just to kind of give a quick overview to people who aren't familiar with the call option trade, these are bonds which we're buying at a discount anywhere from, call it 50 cents on the dollar to 80 cents on the dollar. And the expectation is that these deals will get called at par by the person who owns the call rights. In this case, like NRZ owns the majority of the call rights. They would call the deals because they could buy the collateral at par and they could sell the collateral at greater than par given where rates are. There are multiple factors that go into this, but that's one of the big upsides that we've had, across all our different funds. So we do think there's a lot of opportunity in a legacy resi. Like some other sectors, it is tough to get scale. So again, we're very happy with the portfolio we have created, and we think there is room to run on that.
Thanks, Shamsha. That's exactly what I mean by embedding convexity in the portfolio. So when we look at some of these bonds, we think about a yield to maturity component. Shamsha had mentioned the call option. This is a trade that we identified, 2016-17. We've been able to accumulate the trade in size. And what that means is, running to maturity, we can get a mid-single digit type asset with 6, 7, 8 years of duration to the asset class, but there's a little known nuance where the servicer can effectively collapse the trusts, pay par for all of the underlying assets, and receive the loans. And we think that they'll do it if they, A, own the call right, B, if the underlying pool of loans is worth more than par, and see if they can sell those loans for more than par or resecuritize them. And so we've identified or tagged pools of collateral that are near that 10% deal factor, and that's what we've accumulated. So when I say convexity, if we can buy two bonds with the exact same return profile to maturity, but one of them has significant more upside to call, that's the one that we've tried to buy. And you can only really dig into those details if you have the collateral strats and the level of detail that we do on the underlying collateral. So having an average dollar price of 85 or so on our resi book means that we think there could be, at least on these trades that we identify as having some callability, 15 points of immediate upside. All the time in structured credit, I talk about either yield getting pushed out or yield being pulled forward. So this is a perfect example where we can buy something that we think has, you know, a mid-single digits yield, you know, for 6, 7, or 8 years. But in the case where the servicer collapses it, it basically pulls all of that yield forward, and that's that convexity pop where you can see something priced at 85 in the market, but then the servicer is going to collapse the trust and pay us par for it. And so we try to embed this optionality across the portfolio, but I think legacy resi is a perfect example of that.
Okay, great. And then on the legacy RMBS, what portion of it is this call option?
I'll tell you in a second, because we break up call option also into subcategories. It's roughly 7%. That's 7% of AUM. So 7% of total AUM is the call option trade.
John, sir, what percent of the allocation to non-agency resi?
25%.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Great job last year. Thank you.
And there are presently no further questions on the phone lines at this time.
All right, everyone. It looks like there's no further questions. We'd like to thank everybody for joining the quarterly call. Performance year-to-date is off to a great start. Clay, Jamshed, Simon, and Matt and the rest of the team have done an excellent job navigating through the COVID-19 pandemic, and we anticipate great things ahead as well. So thank you for joining us. Please stay safe, and we are happy to circulate a replay call out shortly. We also have a marketing piece that goes in more depth on the aviation ABS. If anybody would like to request it, please do so. Great. Thank you very much. Clay, Jamshed, Simon, thank you.
Thanks.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.